I could hear how his heart was breaking at the thought of it falling apart. When we started talking about Jaden, his voice changed. I looked up, disquieted by his tone. He dropped his chin and said, "Soph, I've got to make this work. I can't lose Jaden." And for the first time in the 25 years that I'd known him, I saw Chris Lighty cry. I watched just a few tears fall. Maybe it was because of the surreal nature of the moment. Maybe it was because his eyes were so big and beautiful. But those teardrops appear huge, like clear chandelier crystals. All I wanted to do in that moment was what he had done for me for decades, to shelter him from the storm, to tell him it was all okay, and envelop him so that the outside world couldn't touch him. I told him that everything would be all right, but I didn't know that. I had to find something to say to fill the agonizing silence. I told him there had to be some way to make things better, but I didn't have any suggestions. I wanted nothing more than happiness for this man who meant so much to me. But his life was ever so complicated. Chris paid the bill and we went to a hotel down the street. He checked in and we went up to the room. It wasn't a fancy hotel, it was something like a Hampton Inn, but it was close to his office and home, and he could have some peace there. He was clearly exhausted. He brushed his teeth, changed into a t-shirt and sweats, and got into the crisp, queen-sized bed. I turned the lights down and sat on the edge of the bed next to him. Chris lay still, stiller than I'd ever seen him. I held his hand and massaged his big, stubborn forehead until he fell asleep. I let myself out of the room quietly. Just as I was leaving, he said, "Thanks, Soph." It was one of the most intimate moments I'd ever spent with him, and though under unfortunate circumstances, I will cherish it for the rest of my life. Because I think I was able to offer him the gift of sanctuary, which he had given to me countless times through our friendship. Some months later, Chris told me that his wife had accused him of being a sociopath. It had clearly upset him. "You're not a fucking sociopath, Chris. You're not. I don't know a lot about it, but I know enough to know that you're not that." I hated that someone could make him doubt himself in this way. I couldn't stop thinking about the conversation and emailed him a sociopathy checklist of symptoms with the subject line, "You are not," in all caps. He responded, "Hey, God bless. Focus on your family and don't worry about me. Your family needs you. I'm sorry about your father passing. He's on to a better place." Something must have happened that afternoon because he called me the next morning with this message. "Soph, you have to stop emailing me and sending BBMs. Just call me from now on. I don't want to pull you into this shit and for you to be subject to all of the negative energy." "Okay, I want to see you. I need to ask you something, and I'd rather do it in person. Can I come by today?" "Sure, come in the afternoon." I stopped by in the early afternoon after the gym. We sat out in the open area of his office and talked about family and work. After a while, he got up. His older son was at the office, and they were about to get lunch. "Soph, come with us to get sandwiches." As we walked down 16th Street, I told him that I was trying to move into a bigger apartment in my rent-stabilized building. They wouldn't accept my mother as a guarantor because she lived in Canada, so I was wondering if he wouldn't mind doing it. It wouldn't involve any money, just a signature. He said that he'd get back to me. As we turned the corner and headed west, I noticed that he had some talcum powder on his shirt. I hadn't seen it in the office, but outside in the blazing hot summer sun, I saw the trace of stark white against the solid black of his pristine polo shirt. "Did you get your head cut today?" I asked, knowing that his barber came to his office two or three times a week to clean up his lines. "Yeah." I reached up and lightly dusted the powder off his big shoulder. He didn't even turn his head to see what I was doing. He trusted me like that. He wasn't exactly a warm person, and certainly not one for public displays of affection, but he knew I enjoyed it and at times needed it, and he wouldn't flinch when I touched him. Grimace, maybe, but never flinch. As we got to the Panera Bread on Union Square East, he turned to me and said, Come by and see me tomorrow, Soph. Okay. I grabbed him around the chest and held him tightly. I love you, Chris. Thanks for everything. See you, Soph. I watched him and his son go into Panera, and then walk down Union Square East, my head a little higher, my stride a little longer, my resolve a little stronger, as it inevitably was after I saw Chris. He always gave me a shot of confidence and a sense of invulnerability. I thought it was odd that he asked me to come by again the next day, because we never saw each other 2 days in a row, but I was happy that I'd see him again so soon. The next day, August 30th, 2012, New York City was typically hot and muggy. I was having lunch with Elizabeth Mendez Berry at Angelica Kitchen, the East Village vegan fixture. I planned on going to see Chris after lunch. I was wrestling with the menu, disheartened by the choices, when I saw that Joan was calling. I ignored the call because I thought it could be a mistake since we hadn't yet reestablished contact even after my father's passing. She called again, then sent a text. Soph, please call me. I excused myself and went outside. Hey, Joan, are you okay?
It's Chris, Soph. He's in the hospital. He shot himself in the head.
I went numb. What?
Tip called me. He's in a hospital in the Bronx.
Can we go see him?
No, not yet. I'll let you know when I hear back from Tip.
I went back inside and told Elizabeth. We finished lunch and I went to the gym, waiting to hear more. Joan called and said that someone had posted RIP Chris Lighty on Facebook. I called that person immediately. Hey, I heard that you posted RIP Chris Lighty on your Facebook page. Will you please take it down? Why should I? Because I know that Chris wouldn't want it up on a Facebook page. Well, I'm not going to take it down because it's true, he said smugly. I hung up. My head was reeling. My heart was crashing. I was contending with two emotions. The first, anguish. The second, rage at this dumb motherfucker playing Chris's death as some sort of credibility card, as people do in the race to show that they've heard the bad news first and want to announce it to the world. I called Michael and Jizza and Janet to tell them. While I was talking to Janet, whom I'd worked with decades before at Jive, I started to break down. I finished my workout, showered, and went home in a daze. On the morning of September 5th, I woke up and checked the weather on New York One, like I do every other day. Sunny with some clouds, high of 81. But unlike every other summer day, I didn't mindlessly throw on shorts, a tank top, and sneakers to head to the gym. No. This day, I took my time with each element of my outfit. A black Vivian Tam crochet dress, black patent leather Prada stilettos, and of course, my black leather Gucci fedora. I took a car up the east side to the Frank E. Campbell Funeral Chapel, where I met Beth Ann Hardison and Janet. The streets were packed. When they let us in, the hallways and room were jammed. Like so many shows he had been a part of, it was standing room only. Mona Scott, who had worked with Chris and went on to create the hugely successful Love and Hip Hop TV franchise, spotted us and escorted us to the front of the line. As we approached the casket, my heart started to drop. Thank God Beth Ann and Janet were on either side of me, because my body crumpled when I saw Chris lying there in his dark suit, asleep for eternity. In that split second, I suddenly had the agonizing realization that I would never hug him again, never cry on his shoulder again, never hear his laugh again. And it broke me. I burst into tears and my knees gave way. Beth Ann and Janet each grabbed an elbow and supported me down the aisle. Mona seated me with the family. When I saw little Jaden, I lost it all over again. He was only 5. So young, so innocent, and probably barely aware of what was going on. Afterward, Beth Ann, Janet, Joan, and I walked over to EAT on Madison. We sat outside and didn't exchange many words. Anything that had transpired between Joan and me melted away and seemed meaningless compared to the love we shared for Chris and one another. One of Chris's parting gifts was reuniting us. I was so glad my mother was staying with the kids and me at the time. I was a mess. She was so sympathetic. One night, as I was about to get something out of the hallway closet, I simply crumpled to the floor, sobbing. My mother said to the kids,
"Your mom is very sad. She lost a really good friend."
I asked her if she understood why it was hitting me so much harder than with my father's death, and she said,
"Of course. Chris was so young. Daddy was 81.
I talked to a number of mutual friends in the wake of Chris's death. Many asked, "How did he seem? Did you notice anything?" Because I had seen him less than 24 hours prior. If there were signs, I didn't read them. In the past, when he had revealed something troubling, I would probe, but he would quickly change the subject. I don't think he wanted me to see the depths of his despair. I wonder if I should have pushed harder. But D-Nice, who was also very close to Chris, said, "Soph, he gave some to you, some to me, some to other people. I know all of this, but I still hang on to guilt. How did I not see any of the stress that must have been weighing down on him so heavily? Why didn't he tell me? I fear that I burdened him unfairly. I so needed him to be my superhero that he must have felt like he couldn't disappoint me. And I realized that I was only one of probably scores of people who counted on him that way. Big as his shoulders were, how could any one human being support such a heavy load? Believe me, this is not easy for me to talk about. It blows a cold, clean hole right back through my heart every time. I do so in the hopes of starting a broader and deeper conversation around the issue of mental health. Perhaps this will encourage someone who's listening to seek help or reach out to a loved one who may be struggling with depression. Within 6 weeks, I had lost two of the most important men in my life, but the impacts of their deaths were so dramatically different. My father's passing was a long time coming. We had years to prepare. By the time he left, his quality of life was so drastically diminished that it was almost a relief. It was like watching a slow steam train approach from the horizon, like a Turner oil painting. We had time to get to the tracks, stand, and wave as it passed lazily by. When Chris died, I felt like I was blindsided by a bullet train and didn't even realize that I was on the tracks. What I am grateful for is that I took every opportunity to tell Chris earnestly, explicitly, and vividly how much and why I loved him. I had sent him a note via BlackBerry Messenger on May 13, 2010, just a few days after his 42nd birthday. "I hope you see yourself now as clearly as I've always seen you. Brilliant, enigmatic, caring, generous, loving, protective, intuitive, sympathetic, empathetic, savvy, insightful, incisive, strong, honest, loyal, ferocious, fearless, bold, forthright, kind, charismatic, funny, charming, laconic, bullish, confident, unflinching, arrogant, analytical." "I am trying," he responded. "And above all, good, truly, inexorably, fundamentally good. Don't ever let someone make you doubt that, Chris. It's at your very core and ultimately motivates you, regardless of whatever else is going on. I will never let you forget, because I know it." "Thanks," he exclaimed. "No, thanks, Chris. It's what I am bound to you to do. It really, really hurts me to see you doubt yourself. Remember today and every day that no matter what you do or where you go, that this little girl with a big, big heart, loves you with all her might. I believe it is a primal human need to be loved and a deep desire to be told that you are loved. The tragic truth is that many of us wait until we're standing at a podium in front of a flower-covered casket to express these sentiments. I implore you, hit pause now. Call someone important to you and tell them how utterly you love them. I'll wait. Chapter 11, Doors Open.
Soph, it's going to be a little hard for you to find a man because you're hard as nails.
What are you talking about?
You're this little woman, but have this huge personality. You boss people around. You're strong as shit.
So what? That doesn't mean I'm hard.
Yes, it does.
You know, Raphael, I'll talk to you tomorrow. Frustrated, I cut the conversation short. Let me call the man who's known and loved me for years, who knows that I'm as soft and sweet as cotton candy. He'll make this right.
Peace, Soph.
Peace, BFF. I am so mad.
Wow, what happened, Sophie?
I just got off the phone with Raphael, and he had the nerve to tell me that I'm going to have trouble finding a man because I'm too hard. Can you believe it? He just doesn't know me like you. He just hasn't been around me enough. No response. I pull back the phone to see if we'd been disconnected. Math? 2 more seconds of brutal silence followed. Then a deep, deliberate intake of breath, like a long, slow pull on a blunt.
Well, you is kind of hard, Sophie.
What? What are you talking about? I'm not hard. You've held me so many times and made me feel better. You see me cry. You know who I am.
Yeah, Sophie, all that is true. And I know that. But you do be acting kind of hard a lot of the time. So maybe Raphael's right. Maybe a man won't see you like I do.
I thought I'd learned the lesson to let my guard down, to let the soft balance out the hard, like in Tai Chi. 20 years before, I had had a similar talk with my friend Benny Medina. It was a picture-perfect Los Angeles day. I drank in the sun, chin up to the blue sky, and let the wind hit my face, right arm dangling out of his shiny black vintage 450 SL drop top. As we made our way through West Hollywood, the conversation turned to relationships. So what are you looking for in a man, Sophia? Someone who will take care of me and make me feel safe. Look, Benny, I run shit and pitbull all day, but when I get home, I want to hang up the superwoman cape at the door, curl up on my man's lap like a kitten, and have him hold me and say, "It's okay, baby." Silence. I looked across for a response, but his mouth was agape. What? I can't believe that's what you're looking for. I never would have guessed it. I had earned my reputation as an independent, no-nonsense kind of woman who took care of everyone else, and I guess I didn't let anyone see that I, too, wanted to be cared for. If I wanted the relationship I was describing, I'd have to allow myself to be emotionally naked. One warm fall day in 2012, not long after Chris's passing, my old friend Dom Turnier, rest in peace, called and said he wanted D'Angelo to train with Yan Ming. No matter what I was feeling about Yan Ming personally, I would never tell someone not to train with him. Dom gave me Dee's number and asked me to talk to him about it. I looked at the digits and dialed. The phone rang a couple of times. "Peace," a voice said, low and soft. "Peace, Dee, it's Sophia Chang. Dom asked me to call you." "Yeah, he told me you'd be calling." As I lay on my back on my queen-size bed, looking at the sun shining down on Alphabet City, we talked about training before the conversation turned to other topics. Loss, old dirty bastard, when we'd met before, which somehow I didn't remember, shockingly. Music, divine vessels, family, hometowns, church, and so much more. I rolled onto my stomach, propped myself up on my elbows, and looked in the huge mirror that stays by my bed. I studied myself, because I wanted to remember how I felt during that conversation. You see, back in 1999, when the whole world gasped at the naked wonder of D'Angelo's body, his palpable sexuality, and unmistakable falsetto, Sophia Chang was 7 months pregnant. And tasting his brown sugar couldn't have been further from my mind. Of course I saw the video from Untitled and was duly impressed. But I wasn't devouring music as I had before. I hadn't grown up on the rich tradition of R&B that would have given me context to prepare me for the stunning arrival of D'Angelo, a man who sang like an angel in a heavenly choir, but rocked cornrows like a straight thug. I didn't fall in love with the naked, sweaty, perfectly sculpted D'Angelo. I fell in love with Michael Archer 13 years and several pounds later. I was entranced and intrigued, not by the myth, but by the man who revealed himself as being sensitive, empathetic, caring, as well as incredibly funny, phenomenally smart, and deeply intellectually curious. I remember that conversation, or rather, how it made me feel, pun intended, as clear as the chords of a Hammond B3 organ ringing through church on a Sunday morning. There were two things Michael Archer said to me that stood out in particular. The first was, "Sophia, I'm a God-fearing man." The second was, "I love you," which he said 3 times in those wondrous 90 minutes. It wasn't the "I love you" of budding romance, but the discovery of a deep, soulful connection. And though I felt the same, I didn't say it. But I didn't need to. He knew it. The universe had kept D'Angelo and me separated for decades, now to unite us forever. We can go without talking for months, but we are never apart. He is one of the most expressive people I know and is constantly commending me about things that I don't see in myself. We're friends in a way that we were never lovers, and I think that's for the best. This love is, as Luther Vandross would say, never too much, always and forever, and so amazing. D'Angelo was put in my life to remind me how it feels to be vulnerable and fall in love, even though we chose to be friends rather than lovers. His gentle spirit, magnificent capacity to love, and sultry tenor pulled back my defenses and compelled me to tune in and listen to my heart. After years of skirting commitment, I was prepared to pledge my heart to one man again, with his assistance. There is a special kind of growth that I only achieve when I'm in love and have the emotional intrepidity to allow myself to be truly open. I wasn't looking, but I wasn't blocking anymore either. I've never gone out in search of love, but when I have opened my heart to the universe and fully humbled myself before her bounty, she has granted me the gift of love. The question was, now that my heart had been opened, who would step inside? Just a month after I had encountered the quiet storm of D'Angelo, there was news of a hurricane headed our way. In my 25 years in New York, I'd survived snowstorms, heat waves, and blackouts, but no hurricanes. How bad could it get? 2 days before Halloween, Hurricane Sandy made landfall, and it was catastrophic. The lights went out that night. I put on a brave face for the kids, but for the first time while living in New York, I was truly scared. Our building's front door was secured by an electronic buzzer that was no longer working. I pictured midnight marauders coming in to pillage. We lived on the 3rd floor, but I'd seen our super scale the patios up to our floor one day when I was stuck inside because the lock had malfunctioned. I stepped into the eerily pitch-dark hallway using my cell phone as a flashlight. I had stood in that exact spot thousands of times before, but never in utter blackness. It now seemed completely foreign. As I moved toward the elevator, I heard an odd sound. As I got closer, I realized it was gushing water, like there was a waterfall directly behind the doors. I thought if they'd opened, a wall of blood would come cascading out like in The Shining. I rushed back into the apartment, bolted and chained the door, lit a candle, and put a 10-inch chef's knife by my bedside. All I could think of was keeping the kids safe. That was one of the longest nights of my life. I barely slept. The next day, I managed to call Joan on my supercell. All the major servers were down in the bottom half of Manhattan, but somehow His little Metro PCS flip phone was working. God bless him. His eyes were blood red. He hadn't slept or rested at all. Apparently, the noise I heard in the elevator was the water rushing into the basement and flooding up the shaft. The kids and I packed some clothes and headed uptown. Lower Manhattan looked post-apocalyptic. Hundreds of people with huge backpacks and suitcases migrating uptown. We kept walking farther west and north until we finally caught a cab. The Upper West Side, on the other hand, looked completely normal. We were so relieved to get to Jones. We crammed into her studio apartment with her and her son, Sule, who was a close friend of the kids, and had a wonderful time cooking and watching movies. It was like a camping trip. When we were finally able to come back home, we had to throw everything out of the fridge and freezer. That was a huge loss, particularly because among the bounty were three of my mother's famous homemade apple pies. Once we'd settled in, I decided to splurge. I bought flounder fillets as a way to treat the kids and celebrate our return with a special meal. I prepped the fillets their favorite way, just like my mom had taught me, dipped in egg and lightly breaded in flour, salt, and pepper. They smelled delicious as they sizzled in the mix of butter and olive oil. Just as they had gotten to the perfect shade of golden brown on one side, I knocked the frying pan clean off the stove. My shiny, stainless, all-clad 12-inch sauté pan that Hesok had bought me for Christmas spun in the air like a fucking ninja star, and the fish splattered all over the floor that Jinlong had just washed. The kids froze, eyes wide. All that food and money and effort wasted. I looked at our delicious dinner creating a mess on the newly cleaned hardwood and dropped to my knees, defeated. I'm so sick of being off my game. I'm so sick of not being able to take you out for dinner and having to cook every meal, I said, crying. The kids immediately knelt down, hugged me, and started cleaning.
What can we do, Mommy? You already do so much,
Jen Hong said.
Do you want to go for pizza tomorrow night? I'll pay.
She was 10. She was willing to spend the money she'd saved up from every birthday card her grandparents had sent her to give me a break. In a flash, my kids turned into caretakers, and I was so proud of them. This was a low point, sitting on the floor, crying over spilled fish. For Christmas that year, Hesok gave me a small plastic Muji box filled with 12 envelopes, each labeled with the month of the year, and containing a neatly folded, crisp $50 bill. He called it the Flounder Fund. He had perfectly embodied the idea that my friend Beth Ann Hardison, legendary model manager and fashion activist, once told me. Family is a verb, Sophia. As we welcomed in the new year, Michael, who always epitomized the concept of family as a verb, presented me with yet another great opportunity. Q-Tip had asked him to be his manager, to which Michael's immediate response was,
on one condition, that Soph is part of the team as well.
That's some ride or die shit right there. Michael knew that I would be a valuable addition to the team, but he was also looking out for his mentee and her family. Like Rizza and Jizza, everyone was a Tribe fan, and there was no door that Tip's name couldn't open. However, I didn't have the freedom to knock on as many doors as I wanted because his management comprised a team of four, which limited my purview and commission. Working with Michael was always a dream, but the complications and duplication of efforts were frustrating in this scenario. The top of 2013 also signaled a shift in my heart that had been catalyzed by D'Angelo. Exactly 6 years after I'd announced to my shrink that my marriage was over, I told myself that I was open to love again. I'd enjoyed more than enough paramours to reconstitute my ego and wondered who would be able to pull Excalibur out of the stone and tame this feral filly. I imagined that he would be around 50, divorced, and with kids like me. I knew it wouldn't make sense to date someone who wanted children. My uterus was permanently closed for business. I wasn't sure where I would meet my prince as my social life was still pretty anemic. The one consistent pulse was going to see Q-Tip DJ every week at Output in Williamsburg, just a quick ride over the bridge. I would make sure everything was straight, then dance for hours, often by myself. Kung Fu requires discipline and focus. The Sophia who emerges through martial arts is a fearsome warrior. Dancing is the opposite for me. I pay no attention to form, only to rhythm. The Sophia Chang who was released through dance is a liberated lover. Both are forms of meditation and vital components of my being, identity, and self-care. Likely because my spirit and body are so free when I'm dancing, I've never had trouble meeting men in clubs. I think it's also much easier because I'm not emitting the energy that says I want to get married or have children. Having those milestones behind me changed the dating landscape dramatically. Because I wasn't looking for anything serious, I sashayed with a lot of younger men who tend to like being with older women because we know our bodies better and say what we want. Shout out to the younger men out there. Thank you very much, boys. I had a lot of good, but not amazing sex because it takes time for me to build the trust and create the interbody dynamic that is fully satisfying. And the added component of being in love always deepens the pleasure. But all these men helped me start to see myself as a desirous and desirable woman. I felt empowered to stretch myself sexually and explore new territory. I'm hardly saying I'm some supernatural lover. I think fucking is like a water level sport. I'm only as good as my partner. I'm sure there are men out there who would say I was an underwhelming lover, and that would be true in many cases, because the chemistry wasn't there. However, I will say that when the circumstances are right, I do go above and beyond the call of booty. One of the great things about getting older is being able to have candid conversations about coitus. My demands are simple: respect and discretion. I have other rules of engagement. I don't fuck with other women's men. It's not necessarily a moral thing. It's a messy thing. I don't judge what anyone else does, but I can't stand drama. The thing about me and my girls is that fucking us is never just about pussy. We're the whole package: beauty, confidence, wisdom, and brilliance. Meaning that we don't just linger in your loins. We stay on your minds, too. And that is a dangerous cocktail for a married man. Caveat emptor, boys. Before engaging too deeply, I tell men, I don't care who you're fucking as long as you're being safe and you keep it out of my house. I also ask these three preemptive questions. Do you have a wife? Do you have a girlfriend? Is there someone out there who thinks you're her man? The final one is important because men might think they're not attached, but have led some poor woman to believe that she is the one. The questions don't guarantee the truth, but at least I've asked and made my own intentions and values clear. At some point, I learned to ask a fourth. Do you have a pregnant ex? Because I walked into that situation twice. Not once. Twice. Yo, men are foul. I was ready for a good one. On November 14th, 2013, I attended a friend's birthday party at a swank hotel penthouse on the Upper East Side with my friend Jay Period, the DJ. The invitation said the dress code was formal, which seemed odd for a birthday party, but I complied, having no shortage of gear to suit the occasion. I was in black from the top down. My Gucci brim, a silk halter top, a floor-length skirt, a fur-collared satin embossed jacket, and short boots. The room was full of hip-hop alumni. It was like a high school reunion. I met a couple of cute men and exchanged numbers before Jay and I cut out to see Q-Tip DJ and meatpacking. When we got back to the party, I noticed some newcomers. One in particular caught my eye. He was sitting slouched on the corner of the couch in a sloppy red beanie, leather jacket, and jeans. Apparently, he hadn't been briefed on the dress code. Despite the hat pulled low over his face and his recumbent posture, I could see that he was handsome, tall, and lean. Just my type. He spotted me making my entrance and watched me hold court. He then stood up, strode over to me, and introduced himself. Sound familiar? He got points right there for having cojones. His name was William. We started talking and I told him that it was really pretty outside, so we went upstairs to the roof deck. We stood looking out at the city in the cold fall air and it already felt romantic and sexy. And groan. Eventually, he asked for my number. He called me the very next day and said, I'd like to see you this weekend, Sophia. not, what are you doing this weekend? Which I think is some bitch shit that men do to preempt rejection. Look, if you're going to ask me out, walk a straight fucking line. Don't take the circuitous route trying to figure out if I'm busy or worse, hope that I ask you first. Neither William nor I was interested in games. We never waited for a certain amount of time to respond to a text or didn't call even when we wanted to talk to one another. We planned to see each other a few days later. I watched as William walked toward me on 8th Street from Avenue C. I drank in every step. He wore a Gautier black leather motorcycle jacket and slim black jeans. He had a confidence and ease in his gait. We went around the corner for dinner. Afterward, he walked me home and kissed me in front of my building. His lips were soft. His hands were strong. He held my waist, and I could feel his fingers on the small of my back. I was not going to leave this kiss on the sidewalk, so I invited him upstairs, but it would be a while before we actually had sex. Usually, I wasted no time getting into bed because that was often all I was looking for. But there was more here. I wanted to wait. One of the things that I loved about William was that he never pushed. He always let me set the pace. After that first date, he asked what else I wanted to do. I told him that I'd never walked over the Brooklyn Bridge in the 26 years that I'd lived in New York. William called the next day and announced that he had made a plan. We would walk over the bridge to Brooklyn and take a car back. You see, that's what a man does when he wants to send a signal to a woman. When he wants her to know that he's listening and wants to please her. He picked me up and we walked over the bridge. It was a cold, clear day and we stopped halfway up, like all the tourists, to take a picture. This nascent bond felt substantial, real, like it had a future. Over the next few weeks, we saw each other once or twice a week and always ended up in my bed. We engaged in lots of extracurricular activities, but not actual intercourse. I was still seeing a few other men, but becoming less interested in anyone else as I became more attached to William. Shit, did she just say attached? I started falling, hard, and I was straight shook. This would only be my third serious relationship in almost 50 years. He was younger, handsome, charming, and out a lot because he worked in nightlife. I was scared to ask if we were together and exclusive. I kept putting off this conversation, but every time we saw one another, I got in deeper. I had built up so much suspense around the answer that just asking the question felt like a dive off a tall cliff without knowing if there was a net to catch me. Around mid-December, I started wondering if we would spend New Year's Eve together. It had been years since I'd kissed a man at the stroke of midnight, and more than anything, I wanted to kiss William to bring in 2014. I was ready, but not confident enough to ask him. Finally, he invited me to see him DJ at a hotel in Manhattan. They had provided him with a room for the night. I wondered if there would be any conspicuously attractive women vying for his attention. Would I walk in to see him chatting up some pretty young thing? I got to the door and took a deep breath as I entered. I saw William before he saw me and let out a sigh of relief. He was focused on his music, looking terribly handsome, in a navy suit and tie. He looked up and a big smile spread across his beautiful lips. I hung out with him at the DJ booth and met some of his friends. When the countdown to 2014 started, I was standing right next to William. I would not miss this moment for the world. 10, 9, 8, 7, down to 1. When he grabbed me around the waist with both hands and planted a hard, warm kiss on my lips. He kissed me as if to say, I'm here. I'm here for you, and only you. I closed my eyes and let myself experience this moment for all of its weight. I hoped that I was reading the signals right, but there was only one way to know for sure. Ask. Shortly after midnight, I went up to William's room at the hotel and got into bed. I fell asleep waiting for him. I was awakened by a gentle kiss on my forehead. I looked up and he said he was going to shower. When he emerged from the bathroom, I was wide awake with anticipation and excitement. I knew that tonight would be the night we would make love for the first time. He climbed into the bed next to me, smelling perfectly fresh and completely edible. He leaned over and kissed me, and we fell into each other's bodies as we had done several times before. But this time it was different. I would finally let him in. I rolled on my back and opened my legs. "Do you have a condom?" Of course he did. Even in that moment, I wondered, does he carry one around all the time in case he's going to get a quick fuck? The thought melted when he kissed me again and I closed my eyes. I opened them to see that he was hovering over me, looking at me. "It's time." When he finally did push inside of me, I uttered a long, low gasp that rose from the depths of my heart and soul. I love the breathless moment right before penetration with any man. But with William, it was all the more delicious because I wanted him so badly and we had taken our time. All the kisses and caresses and foreplay led to this one incredible moment of entry that only lasted a second, but that I would remember forever. The first time, and everyone thereafter, was easy, organic, and profound. Not only because William's dick game was so on point, but also because the richness of the experience was deepened by how much I liked him. As we lay in bed, I finally worked up the nerve to ask him about the elephant in the room. I couldn't even look him in the eye, so I waited until he had turned away momentarily. "Hey, I have to ask, are you seeing anyone else?" He turned around and looked straight at me. "No, are you?" I cannot describe my sense of relief. "No, and I'm glad you aren't, because if you were, honestly, I would have to leave because I like you way too much, and I'm in really deep." Just moments after the end of the year that had started with me saying that I was open to love again, here was William, and we loved each other so damn hard. He was thoughtful, patient, generous, calm, calming, intuitive, and attentive. He took care of me in a way I hadn't known, perhaps in a way that I hadn't allowed. In some ways, being with William was the diametric opposite of my relationship with Yan Ming, who had been the sole focus of my universe before the children arrived. Another striking difference was that William and I never, ever fought. Can you imagine Sophia Chang never fighting? Me neither. This was partly because William was so centered and steady, and partly because I had matured to the point that I didn't blitz headstrong into arguments like I had in previous relationships. There were times I would have welcomed a fight, but he never took the bait. He had an amazing ability to diffuse tension. William taught me to let go. We had a conversation very early about children. I had announced my policy of not having the baby should I get pregnant. William admitted then that he wanted to have children. I told him I didn't want to be the woman who stopped him. "Sophia, I'm a grown man. I can make my own decisions," he said. We spent so much time together during the days and on the weekends when I didn't have the kids. But it wasn't enough. We wanted to be together all the time. That meant he had to meet my kids. The only man who had met my children before was Derek, and that was only once we'd stopped seeing each other, and I knew that we would be friends for life. When William met the children, it was uneventful. The kids were now 13 and 15, and it didn't take as much explaining as it would have had they been much younger. The fact that they were older also meant that they were more independent and didn't spend that much time around him. William eventually moved in, though he always kept his own place. Like with Yan Ming, he met everyone in my life, and they all loved him. I deleted a bunch of men's numbers from my phone and ignored the wolves at the gate. I was all his. Right before my first Valentine's Day with William, Michael surprised me with another work opportunity. The Universal Music Group was looking for someone to run A&R administration and operations. I would oversee all the album budgets on Republic, Def Jam, and Island, and work closely with the legal team to secure the necessary clearances to release an album. Budgeting was far from my passion, but the job would provide me with a steady paycheck and great health insurance for the family. Having no experience in this area, without Michael's backing, I never would have been considered for the position. Despite my own doubts, Michael's faith in me was unshakable. He taught me to trust others' experience and authority if they want to hire me, despite my own reservations. Sheryl Sandberg writes about imposter syndrome in Lean In, and I am very familiar with this beast. I too have vacillated between being super confident about my qualifications and fearful that someone will expose me as a fraud. I certainly felt this way when I took the job at Jive, leaning more toward feeling like a fake. Before the interview, I asked Michael what to say about my children, because the music business fully expects people to work long days, nights, and weekends, and I was not down.
All you can do is be upfront and honest about it, Soph,
he said. So during the interview, I said, if this is a job that requires late hours and extensive traveling, you've got the wrong person. I have to be home to spend time with my children. That's more important to me than anything. I also told them I'd never done A&R administration before, but they assured me that I'd have a staff and it was my job to oversee the department. It had been a long time since I'd been in a corporate interview, but I knew what would resonate. They saw a confident, smart, level-headed adult who was up to a challenge. I focused on my strengths rather than my lack of experience. They understood that my vast and varied resume could counter the corporate calcification that sets in with lifers who have become too comfortable with the status quo. Their main issue was that many of the projects were going over budget, and they described the dysfunction at the different labels. Do you have children? I asked. Yes, they answered. Then you'll understand what I mean when I say that you have a discipline problem, gentlemen. They looked at each other and smiled. In that moment, I knew I had the job. When, and only when, I had signed the employment agreement, I called my mother to tell her I had a steady corporate job with a good salary. Not only did I hear her sigh of relief, I'm pretty sure I felt it on my face from across the continent. Calling my mother with the news was easy. Calling Jizza to tell him I wouldn't be managing him anymore was agonizing. He didn't make it hard. I did. Peace, Jess. I have something to tell you.
Peace, Soph. Is everything all right?
Yes and no. I just got a job offer from Universal, and I'm going to take it. The conversations have been going on for a while, but I didn't want to say anything until everything was confirmed. It's a great opportunity for me and the family. I'm so sorry to have to stop managing you, but they won't let me keep any of my clients.
Oh, okay. That's good. Soph, I'm happy for you.
I want to thank you for letting me manage you. It's been such an honor, and I loved working with you. And I love you so much.
Love you too, Soph.
On my first day at Universal, my staff was brought into my boss's office, and I was introduced as the new head of the department. I found out later that none of them saw it coming. They were not at all happy about it, particularly the woman who was the acting head of the department. I don't blame them. It was a clumsy way to introduce me. That afternoon, I sat individually with each member of my team and assured them that I was not hired to clean house and that their jobs were not in jeopardy. I told them my intention was to help them best I could to optimize their efforts. I asked them to tell me what their workload consisted of, what they would change if they could, and what I could do to make it better. I had an open mind and walked in with a trusting attitude, which was terrifically naive. My friends warned me that it would be political. I had no fucking idea just how political. I always contend the greatest frailty of any organization, large or small, is poor communication. Universal was no exception. People kept others in the dark because they were either careless or territorial, which resulted in duplication of efforts and confusion. At the opposite end of the spectrum were those folks who copied everyone and their mothers on emails in an effort to cover their asses, wasting precious time. One of my key motivations to do more public speaking came from what I observed within the label system. It was full of dissatisfied women, from women in their early 20s who were underpaid, overworked, and underappreciated, to women in their mid-30s and older who were well-paid, overworked, and underappreciated, but with the added indignity of watching their dreams of motherhood become more and more distant with each passing day. It became clear that my experience, particularly as a working mother, could be valuable. After having been so faithfully mentored by Michael and understanding the impact he had had on my life, I was happy to put my energy into helping others. Though there were many hushed conversations about these concerns behind closed doors, there was no open discourse, which is needed to achieve a shift in any culture. So I founded the East Coast branch of the Universal Music Women's Network. It was fantastic to assemble women of different ages, backgrounds, and titles to discuss the issues that impacted us all. I was also taken aback by the racism I encountered there. It surprised me considering the progressive nature of the business and the fact that hip-hop and R&B were such dominant genres and huge sources of revenue. One day my colleague, a white woman, and I were talking about Amber, a black woman whom I had recently hired. She told me Amber would be a good fit for Def Jam. "But she's a rock girl, not a hip-hop head," I said. "How would she be a good fit?" Despite understanding exactly what the subtext was, that because Amber was black, she would work well with other black folks and black artists at Def Jam, I wanted to push her. "She just would." "Well, how so?" "She just would. It's cultural," she said. The language of racism, and all prejudice for that matter, is often highly codified. She had made an assumption about Amber and erased the expertise that Amber had in other areas of music, as well as her professional ambitions. Just over a year after I'd started at Universal, one of my staff came into my office and closed the door. "Sophia, I've been hearing some things. You need to watch your back." She was one of the few people who looked out for me in that snake pit, and I believed her. I told my friend Maria that the knives were out. "Soph, you'd better buy an apartment while you still have a job, otherwise you'll never get a mortgage." That was all it took. She was right. I was making enough money that I could handle a modest down payment, and a letter of employment from a global music corporation would go a long way. I started looking immediately and bought the first apartment I saw, a sizable two-bedroom on the Lower East Side. Things at work started to get a little crazy. There were a couple of women who clearly had it in for me. They were telling my superiors straight-up lies about me. Michael went to see my boss, who said the carping had become untenable. Michael could read the writing on the wall and recommended a perfect solution on the spot. He suggested that I move from working for all of the labels to one in particular, where he knew the president was a big fan of mine. If it hadn't been for him, I would have been fired at that time. Things at work were settled, my kids were growing into gorgeous humans, I was a new homeowner, and I was deeply in love. What a fantastic way to mark my 50th year. I love celebrating my birthday, and this was a big one. William planned the dinner. He had a relationship with the restaurant, and we got a huge private dining room. We got dressed together, but he left before me because he wanted to be there to greet the guests. Michelle and Byron had flown out from LA and were staying with us. One of my friends, Gabe, whom I hadn't seen in a while, grabbed me to say, "Okay, did you order him from a catalog?" William wore a navy suit, and I wore my favorite piece, a forest green First Season Alaya dress. My favorite people in the world were in that room. As I had done on my 40th, I went around the table and toasted my 20 closest friends, telling them why they were all there. I chose to toast William last. I talked about how he had helped me redefine love and find myself after a long marriage and two children. And then, this time, I let them toast me. Many of them talked about the extraordinary and diverse group of friends who had assembled to celebrate with me. After dinner, we went over to number 8, Amy Sacco's post-Bungalow 8 spot. RZA hosted, and DJ Scratch and DJ D-Nice, my two favorite DJs, spun. It was a magical night, and I felt very loved. Watching William do for me what I had done for countless others for decades made me love him even more. And my friends had a new level of respect and affection for him. At one point, I wanted to get air and he walked me outside. Those few minutes in the New York City spring evening with the man whom I love so deeply, holding me tightly and telling me through every part of his body that he loved me, was nothing short of perfect. William, in fact, rarely said those three words. He had told me very early that he wouldn't say it often, and I was fine with it because he walked the walk so hard. One night we were planning on going for dinner. As usual, I was in producer mode and tried to figure out where to eat. He said, "Let me take care of it, Sophia." I honestly don't think I had ever heard those words before. It meant relinquishing control and power. But I needed that lesson, and he chose the perfect spot. It resulted in a more profound love. And, as anachronistic and patriarchal as it sounds, I was happy to let the man be a man, especially in the bedroom. At 50, I was having the best sex of my life. Chapter 12, Letting Go. As we rounded into the fall of 2015, I was beckoned into the president's office mere moments after I had finished mastering an album, which I had A&R'd and delivered on time and under budget. I strolled in expecting a hearty pat on the back, just like in the fifth grade when I thought my teacher was going to tell me that I was such a great student, but I was being told that I was being an unkind dictator. When I walked in and saw the head of HR, I was about to joke, "What, am I getting fired?" Then I realized, oh shit, Sophia, you're getting fired. I was greeted with warm but sheepish smiles and told that they were letting me go because they were restructuring. I would be paid out of my contract, which gave me a full 6 months to find something else. Stunned, I thanked them for the opportunity to work with them and walked out. Despite the murmurings, I hadn't seen it coming that soon. I went into my office, closed the door, and called William. He stopped what he was doing to come straight to me. We packed up my stuff and left the office. I went home and sent a gracious thank you email to everyone whom I'd worked with at the company and separately to everyone outside the company. I was surprised and disappointed, but not hurt. Michael had taught me to not take things personally. By this point, I recognized that the people I worked with were not my family. That's a corporate mindfuck that they employ to squeeze every last cell of work out of you. I knew they didn't give a shit about me. They were beholden to larger mandates that all had to do with the bottom line. William urged me to take the next 6 months to work on my blog and my memoir. People had been telling me for years that I should write a book, and I knew that it was in my future, but I was a serial hustler. I went from gig to gig, and my immigrant work ethic would not allow me to sit back and simply collect a check. I figured I could work and write at the same time. I'd been multitasking for years. This shouldn't be so hard. Michael liked to say,
Sophia's like a heat-seeking missile. Point her in the right direction and she'll get there faster than anyone else can.
My life had taken many different paths, mostly by my own hand. The night I got fired, I texted Steve, a business acquaintance who ran a small label and management company. Hey, Steve, I got fired today. Let's make some money together, I said. Within a week, he hired me as his general manager. I would make all the calls on spending, operations, hiring, and firing. No sacred cows, he told me. I had heard this at Universal as well. Steve told me there was a woman named Jane whom I'd have to fire because despite being thorough and organized, she was widely despised by both the staff and the artists. In the first marketing meeting, I went around the table asking each of the staff for updates on our projects. I started with Jane. I asked about one of our artists, G Herbo, who was slated to perform at the Red Bull Music Festival in Cali. She responded, he's not going to LA until we move his mother out of the hood. She actually smirked and rolled her eyes. The second she uttered those words, I thought, bitch, you're fired. What was so galling was that Jane clearly didn't care. Herbo was concerned because his mother, father, and younger sisters still lived on the notorious east side of Chicago. How did I know? Because I'd asked. Because I'd listened to his music and wanted to know what experiences, at the tender age of 20, could have informed his art with such violence, rage, and pain.
I walked my little sister to kindergarten and we saw a guy get shot point blank in the street. She freaked out, but the crazy thing, Sophie, it didn't even faze me. I had already seen so many murders by then.
He was 13 at the time. Jane had never asked him why he was so worried about his family. Yet she was perfectly happy to make a living off his music, tag along on tour, stunt in the VIP, and smoke blunts backstage. You know, when I read this passage to Herbo, because I said it at a Spotify lecture, he said, Soph, you are the only person in the industry that has ever asked me about my family. And I thought, well, a bunch of fucking assholes. especially when somebody is so clearly worried about his family, not to ask about them, I just think is, anyway. The president was the one to fire Jane, but I was there, coaching him through it. There were a number of others who needed to be cut loose, but they were his boys, and he wouldn't let me fire them, despite the promise that I could run the company the way I wanted to.